Welcome to the American Warrior Festival Podcast, a celebration of our troops, veterans, and American way of life. I'm your host, Dan Clore.
Hello, American Warrior family. This is episode 18 of the American Warrior Festival Podcast, and it's good to be back here. As you could tell, we are in a new location, which is much more professional than we've ever had in the past. So we are very excited to be in our new podcast studio. Producer Don, why don't you tell them the location and the city that we are in?
So this is where the network studios. I'd like to shout out Mike. It's a fantastic, beautiful studio that you guys can see. This is kicking off the plan that we've told you guys about in the past, that we wanted to have a home here in LA, and then we're going to have one in New York that we'll announce in the coming weeks. I know we're on borderline of not Studio City, because we were having this debate yesterday about whether or not this qualifies as,
well, it's Culver City.
Kind of in between Culver City and I can't remember.
Either way, we're in Culver City.
It's Culver City on Google Maps, man. But yeah, I mean, beautiful, and we're excited to bring you guys to LA home. We're gonna be here for a while. Sometimes we'll be in a bigger room when we have more guests and all that. But, you know, today it's just me and Dan, and we're going to have a guest a little bit later for you guys. We see the book here. Mister, I don't want to mess up your last name. I did it in the car. Lieutenant David Van...
Lieutenant Colonel.
Lieutenant Colonel.
Big difference there.
Lieutenant Colonel David Van Bennekom.
David Van Bennekom.
Bennekom. All right.
Yes, sir. So yeah, it's good to be back. What we're going to do today is kind of just get warmed up again, get back in our groove, talk about all the things that we have going on here with American Warrior Festival, some of the new programs we have, some news that we could share that is time sensitive as well. Then we're going to get into the segment with David. So Producer Don, what do we have here first on the list?
So it is it's news and programs. It's been a year, so we got a lot to cover. I mean, which one do you want to start with? We can go over the training program.
Go ahead and follow the list here. We got them all written down.
The new model of American Warrior Fest I guess, what we start with.
The new model of American Warrior, these are things that we have been doing, but we're now putting into a systemized strategy that we are going to roll out with graphs and tighten up our mission statement. And basically what it is we have two pillars with American Warrior Festival. One is focusing on military branded entertainment, what you have known us for in the past, such as live music, the military related films and shows. We've done things like that, along with some new entertainment mediums, such as military based gaming, the podcasts and media, blogs, any type of content that celebrates and brings to light military entertainment to popular culture. Just bringing the awareness out there of what the military does for our country, what it means to our country. It's a celebration of our troops, veterans, and American way of life. So that's what you've known us for in the past. Within the last year, we have rolled out something that we feel is very necessary. There's a lot of groups that focus on the active military and the back end of service with veteran groups. But there's really not a lot going on with pre-service.
Yeah.
The individuals that are getting ready to serve, you know, individuals walking into recruiting stations that want to serve. 70%, this is a stat not a lot of people know, 70% of high school students are not qualified to serve in the U.S. military. And that surprises a lot of people.
And I don't know how much you guys have been watching the news lately, but it's been talked about quite a bit lately, where the number of recruits and joining the military is down from previous years, right? And they need a lot of help. So I think the program that Dan's talking about, I mean, timing wise, couldn't be better.
Right. Yes. It's right on the money right now with what's going on in active military recruiting. The numbers are, I believe, the lowest since, there's a lot of statistics out there, but at least since 1973, some branches are a little bit behind their goal more than others, but it's definitely a thing we want to focus on. So what we've been doing is working actively with recruiters across the country with a focus on the Northeast right now, helping recruiters get individuals qualified, taking on the two biggest challenges and obstacles for these kids that are not qualified, which is the academic side with the ASVAB test, the military entrance exam, and also childhood or youth obesity and the physical fitness standards that the military requires. So those are the two things that we've actively been working on. So we have a program of tutors and fitness professionals that focus on taking care of these kids that in the past have walked into a recruiting station only to realize and find out that they are not qualified. And so usually these kids would just kind of turn right around, head out the recruiting station, and that may be the end of their military aspirations. So with our program, we are able to bring them in and mentor them, train them, teach them, and just be a basic, like a big brother, big sister group for them.
And it's already been successful. We posted a little bit about that on Facebook. Was it the first or second successful?
Oh, we have six. Six kids on the academic side that were failing that are now either in boot camp actively or have a ship date. And we have three, four more that we expect to pass within the next couple of weeks. So we want to hit that double digit number and provide proof of concept to our supporters and the military, the DOD itself. So the American Warrior Military Mentorship Program is something we're very excited about.
I mean, talk about a success rate. You guys started that less than a year or? Right. When it kicked off and it's already
the tutoring, like, 6 months or less.
Yeah.
The program, we have done other events within the program, like marksmanship training.
Yeah.
Certain fitness training with the Marine Corps pulleys. But the academic tutoring definitely is 6 months or less. I can get an exact date, but it hasn't been too long.
I mean, yeah, so. But that's phenomenal. I mean, you're already six and then we have four, maybe five more.
Yeah,
coming down. I mean,
10, hopefully 10 by the end of the year, or the early part of 2023. And we really want to start crushing that in 2023.
So this one's cool. I mean, this is the big one, right? This next topic here that we're going to talk about, the Strength in Numbers Organization nonprofit.
Oh, man. Yeah, this is very exciting for our group, our organization as a whole. So American Warrior, I guess, in fact, our teammate, David Van Beneken, brought this up.
Lieutenant Colonel.
That's right.
Yeah, I got him back.
I believe he brought this up too, and I used it again. We have our McDonald's, and we now have our Ronald McDonald House. And we know to some that can kind of maybe create, I don't want to say confusion, but people will need to understand how that works. And we plan on putting a lot behind it on our websites and our social media so the public has transparency and they can understand the difference of, you know, what our profit company does and what our nonprofit does. And companies will also learn the difference when we present opportunities to them to get involved. So we feel that the benefits of having both a profit and a nonprofit far outweigh any, like, maybe early confusing situations by having that.
Yeah.
'Cause people don't, after a while, McDonald's is a very huge company, but people understand there's McDonald's, there's Ronald McDonald House.
Exactly.
So that's very exciting. We started this whole process kind of as another date with destiny, right? We met the law firm that launched this for us and did this whole, took care of this whole process in a Manhattan Beach dive bar alleyway.
Oh, that's right.
Which seems to be kind of the way we roll.
It's in typical Strength in Numbers American Warrior fashion, that's exactly how it was supposed to come together.
Probably could have wrote, how many emails could we have sent to law firms around the country and probably got ignored?
Yeah.
And we run into this amazing Naval Academy, Harvard law grad. Our boy, Rob Graffam, shout out to Rob and the whole team at O'Melveny & Myers. They are a massive law firm that believed in this upstart underdog company of ours.
Yeah.
And I mean, these guys are rolling in. I mean, they represent Madison Square Garden. They have 15 offices across the world. And the fact that they treat us like we are the top of their priority list is, we can't thank them enough. So O'Melveny & Myers, we appreciate you. Our nonprofit, we have the list of seven things that we do. Now, I'm not sure if it's on our list there, we're going to be doing events for lessons and events for, at children's hospitals, VA hospitals, programs for at-risk youth with our two pillars, entertainment and military training, bringing music and assisting drives, food drives, toy drives, blood drives, clothing drives.
Yeah.
Basically bringing entertainment to those situations. So when someone can get fed, they also can hear songs of hope. We can also take our team and lend a hand to Meals on Wheels or any of those other groups that are focusing on the actual drive. We're there to bring some entertainment and to be extra hands. And how cool is that, turning a drive into
also,
a celebration?
You know, I think all of those things that you listed, everything we talked about, it's things that American Warrior and Strength in Numbers have done over the years,
right,
on a lesser fashion. Like, you know, as much as we could help, we would help and do all these, whether they were shows or like we, you know, last year with the feeding the veterans and all that during the right. holidays, like,
yeah.
And now during COVID. During COVID. Yeah. And now though, with the nonprofit, it allows us to literally, to just take it to that next level and right. really, really do some damage. And I think that's what's most important, is being able to help more people in a broader spectrum, as opposed to, like you said, how kind of the guerrilla marketing or guerrilla style right. that we were doing. This is allowing us to really take it to that next level, which is always the goal.
Right.
Reach more people.
People always felt, they knew we were always doing nonprofit type of work, but we just, you know, we didn't have that classification. So a company would say, you know, we really don't want to sponsor per se as an advertiser alone. We just love your mission and want to contribute. We want you to be one of the charities we support. And in the past, what we've been able to do is help all of our partner nonprofits and take care of them. But now,
like, how many times
we get a chance?
How many times did we get those emails or those quiz? Like, oh, well, we could just send you a check to your
501c3 number. Yeah. Yeah.
It's so, like, well, we don't have a nonprofit, so how about we have this nonprofit partner that we work with? You could help them out, you know.
Right, right. And now we have that option. And there are ways that we're approved by, you know, all the legal side of it. There is the way the profit and nonprofit interact is very minimal. Most of the events will be separate, and the way they do interact has all been approved on the books and thumbs up exactly how we wrote it out. So that is really a gift. I mean, it came back and said, this looks good. The way you're going to interact works for everybody. IRS stamp of approval.
And I mean, so, it's exciting. Yeah. It's a big step. I mean, and it's the goal for all of American Warrior Fest and Strength in Numbers is the podcast, the festival, is to really get it going and, you know, take it to that next level. So we're bringing more entertainment, more charities, reaching more troops and more help. And that's just the ultimate goal, right?
Absolutely. So in addition to, okay, after the food drives, we also can raise tuition funds for the military mentorship program, any type of warrior retreat. And last but not least, our nonprofit can be the kind of is able to send the troops, veterans, and the youth to concerts, football games, baseball games. And on the topic of concerts, it probably leads into, and sporting events leads yep. into our next two topics,
exactly.
right?
Exactly.
Since this one is urgent, we have the Raiders versus Steelers. Yeah, no one cares about that. No one cares about that. it's the 50th anniversary of the Immaculate Reception, which to you Steelers fans is a great night. To Raiders fans, it's a nightmare.
Night for the Raiders. Anyway. Yes, nothing different.
Franco Harris, the legendary Steeler, is having his number retired that night. It is on Christmas Eve. So that has been a blessing and a challenge. I mean, it's exciting anytime you can be in an energetic NFL stadium on Christmas Eve with the whole world watching is cool. But also there's a lot of individuals that want to go and they have to decide between their favorite football team or getting divorced.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
So we're really excited about the game itself. And we have a party tent suite, which I'm excited about this because it's kind of a hybrid. It's half sweet, it's half being out in the elements, because right. it's a tent that covers all the seats we have. We have 20 to 27 seats. There's going to be heaters, private entrance, servers, our own catering. So we have catering and a private bathroom. So it's pretty, it's a pretty fancy way to go to a ball game.
And this is not at Allegiant Stadium. This is in Pittsburgh.
It's in Pittsburgh, which it was called Heinz Field.
That's right.
Now it starts with an A. If you want to look it up here while we're talking. I mean, you know, that's the thing with stadiums now, right? I mean, I know Staples Center did the same thing. It's now crypto.com. So a lot of people get used to a stadium name. And now with sponsorships changing, it it changes quite a bit.
But it is, oh, I can't even pronounce that. Accuser? What? How do you? What
is AccuSure? I can't read without my readers.
I think you're right. AccuSure Stadium.
AccuSure. Yeah. Anyways, it's in Pittsburgh. Raiders Steelers Christmas Eve. We do have seats remaining for veterans, active military, supporters, anyone who's interested in going. Just get a hold of us. Go to our website, AmericanWarriorFestival.com. We have free tickets. We have discounted tickets. Just get a hold of us. Tell us your situation, how many tickets you need. The bottom line is we will not have empty seats in that party tent suite.
Yeah.
We're here to you know, give everyone a good time and to celebrate what we're doing together.
And those shows fill up pretty quick. I mean, you know, it's... We were surprised where we've done them before, and it's like, oh, wow, this is, people love this stuff. So it allows us to continue to do it. On that same topic, you want to go to the next big one?
Right, absolutely.
Metallica and Pantera dates. You're all like, what does Metallica and Pantera have to do with American Warrior Fest? But go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, it has everything to do with it. As fact is,
other than the musician.
The live entertainment angle, yeah. I mean, Metallica... Without Metallica, there may not be an American Warrior Festival. And I'll tell you why.
True.
Because A, it's the band that brought me and you to the musical dance.
Yep.
It's the band that made me go to the guitar, you know, House of Guitars in Rochester to go get my first guitar. I mean, Metallica started this whole music thing for me, which led to the band, which led to the concerts.
Yep.
Which led to the American Warrior Festival. So it really, we did two Metallica shows last year, right, Don? We did Vegas.
Vegas.
Which was phenomenal. We did two suites in Vegas.
At Allegiant Stadium.
At Allegiant Stadium, the home of champions.
Keep telling yourself that, but go ahead.
I can't
dog the Raiders too much since they're a big part of American Warriors.
Yes.
Which
kills him as a Chiefs fan.
They have equal opportunity to lose to every other team, so, you know, don't worry. Right, continue.
Yeah, here he is, a huge part of what we do. You know, producer Don has been in the trenches with me really since, we met in 2003 at music school, but since 2011, we've been pounding away.
Yeah.
We did Metallica in Vegas last year, and we did Metallica in Buffalo in August. And both events were amazing. We had two suites each. We had a bunch of veterans in there, a bunch of supporters and sponsors. It worked well.
Yeah.
And we really didn't think much more about the Metallica and Pantera thing. Well, Pantera, for all any of you rock and metal fans, this is kind of a hot button topic too, because here you have, they're bringing the band back, Pantera, as a you know, calling it Pantera, not a tribute. I mean, they're calling it a celebration, really.
Yeah. Well, I guess should we give a little background on what we're actually talking about for like the non-metal fans or non-rock fans?
For sure. Yeah. Explain what's going on with
Pantera. I mean, I'm sure most people know Metallica is kind of a household name. Metallica, one of the biggest, if not the biggest, heavy metal band of all time. Pantera, another big metal band in the 90s, led by the Abbott brothers, Dimebag Darrell, who was the guitarist, and his brother, who was on drums. His name's escaping me.
Phil,
sorry. No, the drummer.
Vinnie Paul,
sorry. Yeah. I don't know, like, why I'm like the Abbott brother, Vinnie Paul. And they formed Pantera. They brought in Phil Anselmo as the lead vocalist and Rex on bass. Huge band in the 90s for metal scene. Unfortunately, sadly, tragically, Dimebag Darrell was killed on stage by some crazy gunman in early
2004.
Yeah. Very tragic. Another senseless, you know, death. And then recently, maybe about 5-6 years ago, Vinnie Paul passed away. So the Abbott brothers both passed, and you know, Panther hadn't done any music, but Zakk Wylde, Ozzy Osbourne fame, stepped up. And like Dan said, this new reformation of Pantera is more of a tribute to, and like, you know, of the old band and the Abbott brothers. Friends with Metallica. And so Metallica's just released a new album and announced this big world tour for the next 2 years.
Next 2 years, yeah.
All over the world, United States, or the US and Europe. And that's what brings us to what we're kind of talking about now, because of that, those dates for 2 years, Metallica, Pantera, all over the world, allows us to do what Dan's talking about here.
Right. We've hit the ground running already. As soon as Metallica announces dates, my phone catches fire, my email. Mm. We're getting known for doing these events, and we do them in suites. And a lot of people are interested in that because, number one, it prevents the Ticketmaster rat race off the jump,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
People trying to get tickets, and whenever you have a suite rep, it allows you to kind of build more of a community situation with the event.
And I've already seen those tickets, just general tickets. Right. Like, you know, I just kind of glanced at Ticketmaster. I mean, they're already up at $500-$600, you know,
right,
just for ticket, regular tickets.
Right.
Like, it's insane.
Exactly. So you're going to pay top dollar just putting yourself anywhere in that stadium. So it's a stadium tour. So right now we're Los Angeles, SoFi, Phoenix, where the Cardinals play, Jersey in MetLife, which we've already done an event at MetLife in last November, not 2022, but 2021.
Oh, yeah.
We did Raiders and Giants on Salute to Service weekend.
Chicago.
Chicago's deeper into the year, 2024.
That's
yeah.
right, yeah.
Yeah, but we are focusing. Yeah, we are focusing on multiple dates. Wherever there's an interest and people want to be a part of it, we are happy to book that date out. So, you know, this Metallica Pantera thing, it's really a labor of love for us, and to be able to get veterans and active military and the youth and anyone who supports what we do into these suites. The best thing about the suites is really just, it feels like family. Relationships that are already kind of, you know, being built, get solidified, new friends are made.
Yeah.
We bring supporters together. I think the best thing about it is seeing a company that put up the money can hang out with a veteran that they sent to that event and see what it meant to that veteran.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they could see where their dollars went, because they can look at the joy in that veteran's eyes and say, you know what? That's why we do this. That was worth the investment. This is what it's all about.
Yeah, I mean, it's so much more intimate and like personal when you get to sit there and you know, like you said, the companies get to see the people that they're helping out, as opposed to just writing a check and you never see, you know, like it's an infomercial or something.
Right. The human connection, right? You can't beat the human connection.
Now, not to be outdone, but in the U.S., Europeans, we're not forgetting about you. We are talking about adding some of those European dates and doing the same thing that we're doing here in the States. So that's kind of being talked about. It's not
right. That is one that we feel we can kind of springboard off the success of the US dates to, I don't know how many European dates we're going to look at, but maybe one or two. I think that'd be very exciting. We're just kind of planting the seeds of how that would look for Europe. But
I'm telling you,
Don't be surprised, because it goes out to 2024.
Yeah.
We absolutely have time to build for that.
And I mean, any metal fan knows, like, Europe, huge, huge rock metal scene. I mean, I think that's going to be, if we're able to do it, it's going to be phenomenal. They're going to be a huge success if we do get to do it. So we'll see. And again, just kind of like Dan just said, planting the seeds.
Yeah. So, well, here's the thing with American Warrior, where we have new team members and new coaches on our team that is helping us greatly. Let's use a military analogy. American Warrior has been built on like the philosophy or the mindset of a sergeant running through walls, maybe not a lot of thinking, just doing. There's thinking and there's doing, there's passion, there's fire, there's definite energy. But sometimes the positive there is when you do things happen, but imagine marrying that with a strategy of thinking like a general would. Mm. setting out targets and goals and timelines and looking at it as a strategic way. So I feel we take what we've always been good at, energy, fire, passion, marry it with the strategy and tightening things up, where we have great team members on our team. Like, you know, in addition to Dave, we have, you know, our good brother, Terry Hagen, who everyone in the American Warrior family
knows.
Shout out
to Terry.
Yeah. I mean, these individuals who are, have been in high leadership roles in the military and also in the civilian world, taking the energy, asking the questions, saying, okay, this all looks great from the high, you know, the big target, the big vision. What are you going to do today to take the steps to tie things up, the details? So with this Metallica thing, it allows us to really create a strategy for the next 2 years and really make Metallica kind of like a foundation of our live entertainment event series that we can build off of. And it makes all the sense in the world, seeing how they're the band that brought us into this whole thing.
No, so. Absolutely. And I mean, and in a way, the stuff that we're doing with the Metallica suites and the concerts, it also, it's kind of springboarding us. And maybe it's the infancy for the ultimate goal that we've always had with American Warrior Festival, which is being along the lines and at the level of what, you know, like a Knotfest or Ozfest, or like kind of, that's always been the dream.
For
Lollapalooza. Veterans. Yeah. For veterans. I mean, that's always been the dream, is to be literally go into one of these open fields and have a huge show, but it's American Warrior Festival, right, and it's directed
towards our event, at that level.
And that is the ultimate dream. So we're thinking and kind of treating this, these little baby steps with the suites and the Metallica shows, like that's part one, you know,
right.
And we start to get into those roles, and maybe we start to, you know, get some more people that we're talking to and start to get known around, like, you know, the Metallica circles, and maybe they approach us. Hey, we want to do a show specifically for American Warrior Festival.
Well, here's an angle right off the jump there. The drummer from Tool, Danny Carey, James, the singer of Metallica, they are now doing programs with nonprofit music programs for kids.
Mm-hmm.
Automatically, there is a future option there to be able to get, you know, players at that level, musicians at that level, to work with our kids.
Yeah.
You know, we had a music academy for how many years? I mean, 10. I've been teaching guitar since I was 22. So I had hundreds of students, and we had the music academy for the better part of 10 years. We absorbed the music academy kind of into what we're doing with concerts. So some of our events coming up do have the academic or the lesson element built in. So it's not like we lost everything we've learned and built there. But there's another angle to kind of, while we're working on the events, getting in with these musicians on a...
So James Hetfield, if you see this episode, hey, give us a call. We're more than happy to help.
Right? So we see all these things coming together and being ways to contact and get to know the people. It'll be
awesome. Like, again, if we get to that point, I mean, being able to, again, go back to teaching, which was always fun. You know, especially, you know, we talked a little bit about the at-risk youth programs that we had back in the day. And I think we've had other episodes where we've talked about that. If you guys don't know, go back to, you know, go into the archives. And I'm sure we've touched it on, you know, previous episodes.
Well, yeah, a lot of the things in the nonprofit we have done. We had the 8-week program with the LAPD in South Central, where we worked with at-risk youth. So that went very well. We've done children's hospitals events. We have done VA hospital events. So a lot of these things we have done. Now we're just ready to refine and provide some consistency.
Oh, so. Real quick, going to touch on, like you said, the running through the wall analogy too.
Yeah.
Not only just, you know, like you said, we always had planning on that, but also it's just, we can't do everything ourselves. And that was always one of our flaws was wanting not only to like plan and build stuff, but also like with me and him especially, we're super stubborn and we're like, we want to like kind of have our hands on everything, do everything, all that too. And like, we like, even though we have people that are more than qualified, usually more qualified than both of us, to get the job done, but we were just those people that like we feel like we have to do it, like we physically have to do it. And obviously, unless we can like master cloning, that's impossible. So, you know,
right,
and so we have to get used to relying on professionals and people that like and their talents and their skills to broaden everything that we're trying to do. and trust that process, which I think is what you're kind of alluding to with that whole thing.
Right. Well, in the early going, you know, a lot of our team members, volunteers, contract work, project by project. You know, I don't see any full-time immediate employees. That's something we'll have to grow into. But building these things out, we are getting more volunteers. We're gaining momentum there. We can get people on commission basis and project by project, like independent contracting work. So that is something as we team build out, we can talk more about. What else do we have on the news and programs as we wrap up this segment?
So no, I think we covered that. That's everything. You know, so I all think right. We're going to take a quick break. I got to pay some bills, you know, shout out to our sponsors. And when we come back, our guest for today, we've talked about his book's been right here for your viewing pleasure. Lieutenant Colonel David Van Benicum. I always have to look at the book.
You'll get it by the end of the episode.
Right. So stay tuned, guys. We'll be right back. Don't miss it.
The American Warrior Festival podcast brought to you by Oliver's Candies, the creator of the American Warrior Festival candy bar. Oliver's Candies is proud to offer you the largest selection of award-winning chocolates made in Western New York. Visit them online at oliverscandies.com.
What's going on, everybody? Don T. Penny here. Just wanted to take a minute to thank our fellow Patreon supporters and let you know that if you wanted to become a fellow supporter of our podcast, all you got to do is click on the link below that is in your show notes. Or if you're listening to this slash watching this on YouTube, all you got to do is go to the video description. We will have a link to the Patreon page right there in that description as well. And that will take you to the homepage where you can see the sixth different options for our Patreon program. Feel free to browse through it, guys. Click on them, see which one best suits you, and any support, any help that you guys would offer us is much appreciated. It helps us put more content out for you and push this podcast to that next level. Once again, guys, thank you for all your support. We're going to continue to do our job. You guys have a great rest of your day. We're out.
The American Warrior Festival podcast is brought to you by the Red Osier Landmark Restaurant, Oliver's Candies, Smokin' Eagle Barbecue and Brew, The Firing Pin, Orcon Industries, Ken Barrett Chevrolet Cadillac, TF Browns, 1 LLP, Batavia Legal Printing, GunTrack App, and AmeriHome Healthcare.
This
is Candy. You're listening to the American Warrior Festival Podcast. All right, welcome back to the American Warrior Festival Podcast. Here we have our guest, Lieutenant Colonel Dave Van Benicum. Dave, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much. I really appreciate the back and forth on pronouncing the name in the last segment, but I'm glad you guys finally got it.
Yeah, we finally got it together. The man deserves the most respect, and getting his name correct is a goal of ours. So Dave, we have a book here, Searching for True Community, and it's a self-help book for national security, which is an interesting way to pitch the book. So we're excited to hear more about it. Why don't you tell our followers a little bit about the book and what your goal was in writing it?
Yeah, happy to do that. Maybe a good place to start off with just a little background on myself. I joined the Marines, 20 years in 1994 or so. Was originally an infantry officer, went through infantry officer's course, did the things that infantry officers do, kind of cut my teeth down in Camp Lejeune. Was moved over to logistics, and really kind of spent the latter part of my career running kind of these big logistics programs, finalizing my time in the Pentagon. At the time we were kind of doing a logistics drawdown from Afghanistan, so all the material and assets that had to come out as part of then President Obama's directed drawdown was the big project I was working at before I retired. Along the way, I just kind of took the initiative, went to law school, kind of worked my way through that at nights and weekends, passed the bar exam, And then when I was in the Pentagon, there was a kind of a program that opened up at Georgetown University Law Center there in D.C. On national security law. So, you know, I just kind of took a stab at it to apply. It was the first year that they had actually kind of started the program, and for some reason they had the, you know, the bad sense to actually accept me. And so I so I went there and really got a really unique look at national security that, you know, I think that most operators don't get a look at. Right. Most of the people that were in the class, you had a number of JAG attorneys that were there. They were there for kind of a year-long fellowship. You had congressional staffers that were coming down from Capitol Hill that they were attending the course. And then, you know, the other side of the coin, you had a number of like human rights activists and those types that were in there to kind of really challenge themselves on international law and those type of things as they apply to national security. So, yeah, I kind of came out. I retired from the Marines, was kind of looking for my next thing, you know, landed at General Electric Capital Corporation up in Stamford, Connecticut, actually Norwalk, Connecticut, a little north of that. And I was, you know, kind of turning to my wife and I said, you know, I've got all this information in my head. You know, I've got all this experience. I really want to write a book about national security. And she looked at me and in one kind of cold, you know, kind of response says, that's boring.
like only a wife or a partner is going to cut direct to it. Like, yeah, honey, I don't know how exciting that is. Right. Is that kind
of it was exactly the response I wasn't expecting. It was like, you know, I sat there and it was like a shot to the gut. You know, it was like, okay, you know, here I am. I've invested all this time in you know, 20 years in the Marines. You know, I went to this fancy school, got this good, great diploma. I was trying to look at a way to apply it. I go to the wife and say, I got this great idea. And she says, yeah, that pretty much blows.
So before you get out your front door, you have your first obstacle with the book.
Yeah. So when I decided really to take first on the jump, challenge, right? I just took on the challenge. I said, you know, all right, well, you know, if she thinks it blows, what I can do is try to write a book that she doesn't think blows, right?
Right.
And if I can write a national security book that she finds interesting, that she finds you know, really something that she'll read, then I think you know, I've kind of won. Right. And yeah. And that's really what I set out to do. And so basically, you know, I really started looking at, you know, what my approach was going to be. You know, I thought, well, I'm going to write a business book on national security because I had this logistics background. I started thinking about, you know, kind of containers and, you know, how do I relate, you know, trucks and movement of goods and those type of things to principles in national security. And it, you know, pretty much died on the vine. But when I was up at GE, I was really exposed to something that I really didn't expect to be exposed to, financial modeling. I actually got there. GE Capital was going through a really huge corporate transition. And for whatever reason, the big powers that be there decided, hey, you know, you're a Marine. So what we're going to do, we're going to throw you in the middle of the PhDs with all the, they're doing all the financial modeling in order to kind of assess risk, right? And so, yeah, as weird of a kind of partnership as that was, I really learned that financial modeling is modeling behavior. It's modeling whether or not you and I are going to default on our loans, you know, given, right, you know, kind of, you know, big economic conditions like unemployment rates and the price of oil and those kind of things, right? And that really just determines, you know, how much liquidity, how much cash they need to keep on hand for the next, you know, kind of potential downturn of the economy. So it just kind of clicked in my head. I was like, well, you know, if we're modeling social, you know, we're modeling kind of behavior, you know, can national security be a social science? You know, can it be, you know, basically something that is really about influencing behaviors, about how do we actually kind of get communities to work together. And so I kind of set down this path, right, to basically relate national security to our local communities. All right, so if you kind of look at your neighborhoods, I'll take my neighborhood, for example, over in Pasadena, you know, every house is, you know, has a different family inside of it. They likely look different. They likely have different culture. Right. They likely practice a different religion. And despite all their differences, they agree that there are some common values that they need to agree upon in order to work well as a community.
Right.
But even with those values and those agreements, right, they really have shelf life. So when those values start to interfere with what we find to be personal to us, our self-identities, our values, right, will often justify, you know, our a reason for us to kind of break from the rules, right? So as we kind of go into the holiday period, right, some of our neighbors are going to put an obscene number of holiday lights, you know, up on their houses, even though maybe the community rule says you need to be a little more temperate in your approach.
Right.
You're going to have neighbors that park their boats on front lawns, even though, you know, the homeowner association says, yeah, you can't do that, right?
Right.
When the community rules start to intrude upon our own, you know, self-identity, right, we tend to kind of want to break away from that. And so if you kind of look at that within our own communities, you can apply that to the community nations. And basically how the community nations works together to build agreements, to work together as a community, right? But how we kind of incentivize behavior one way or another to ensure that when those things become personal to us and when nations become willing to break from the community rules in order to kind of take their own, you know, kind of path, and we see that in places like Ukraine today with Russia and elsewhere, that, you know, how we actually prevent that from happening, for deterring that from happening, is what national security is all about.
Right.
So it's kind of a journey. You know, economics, psychology, religion, the law, right? And really, what it's kind of intended to is to kind of show that, you know, communities can do great things together, but we're not always so great at being a teammate.
For sure, especially when you're talking about all the different you know, religions, the way each country values what they do, and how do you find that connecting fiber? And I think in the book, you also talk about how to, would you even enforce, or is it more of a gentleman agreement, or like, how do you keep people motivated to stay on the path and the
agreement? Like, I think what you're going to, I talk about the book a lot about the power of reciprocity. It's right. The reciprocity is really the glue that holds everything together. So, you know, if you and I have a contract dispute, yeah, we can go to a courthouse and there's the judge there, and the judge will actually, you know, kind of determine which one of the parties is in the right, and, you know, either issue some sort of, you know, kind of directive that, hey, you're going to have to kind of obey by the contract, or maybe they issue some sort of penalties, you know, monetary penalties or elsewise to incentivize one party or the other, right? But there is this kind of the power of the state, right, to be able to enforce the contracts that we are into. In the international world, you don't really have that. You have international kind of organizations like the International Court of Justice, and you have the you know, different types of organizations that you kind of regulate how nations interact with each other. But really what they do is they validate complaints, they justify responses to, you know, to unjust acts. But what really kind of keeps nations in line is that, you know, if one nation doesn't hold up to their end of the bargain, their neighbors aren't going to hold up to theirs as well.
Right, so, it's just kind of a snowball effect.
So the International Court of Justice can say, yeah, China, you're wrong because you're building islands in the South China Sea that you're not allowed to build.
Right.
But they can't enforce that with any sort of kind of law enforcement measure, right? China can just simply say, well, thanks, International Court of Justice, I'm going to keep on building.
Right.
Right. So it really comes down to, you know, the deterrent sometimes, right? So it's the reciprocity of, well, you know, United States as the kind of peer competitor saying, well, you know, if you guys don't stop doing what you're doing, we'll kind of take away, maybe impose some sort of trading penalties, or perhaps, you know, we'll kind of sail one of our, you know, kind of Navy ships through the Strait of, you know, kind of Taiwan to make sure that we're objecting to your, you know, kind of claim that, you know, the South China Sea is your own, right? And so it's really that kind of back and forth that keeps the nations in line, and why, again, I kind of consider it a social science, you know, really kind of how communities work together.
Now the United Nations, is it five primary countries? U.S., United Kingdom, China, France, Russia is. I saw that in your book.
You're talking about the Security Council.
Yes. Exactly. And I was going to ask you, with Russia and China being part of that, and then the U.S. and England, and what's the other one?
France. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. What position are they in now, do you think, with what's going on with Russia and China? How has that affected the Security Council in your eyes?
Well, I think, you know, the United Nations, you know, is stretched, right? Because, you know, any member of the U.N. Security Council can simply veto a response to an unjust act, right? So the whole idea of the United Nations is that it's a collective security agreement. So if there is a justification to use action or military action against another nation, it should be the collective voice of the United Nations that makes that determination. And it's the UN Security Council that actually votes on that. But because, you know, these primary members are given veto authority, they can block any measure. And so that really puts, again, you know, nations in a bind where, you know, we have to somehow figure out how do we interact in a world where there are injustices and there are unjust acts that are occurring. But the process that is used sometimes doesn't work, right? Because, right. You know, each nation is working in their own interests. And so they're willing to veto a measure, even if it makes common sense to the rest of us, that it's just a something that we have to kind of take care of. And so you I think sometimes you'll get into, you know, some situations where, you know, where a nation might actually stretch, you know, kind of the meanings of the treaties and agreements in order to actually do something that they feel is just. And, you know, the example I use in the book, you know, back when, you know, President Obama drew his red line in the sand and kind of said to the Syrians, hey, if you use chemical weapons, you know, we're not going, you know, we're going to kind of do something. We right. don't know what that is. We're going to do something. They use chemical weapons anyway. United States didn't act, right? And there's a lot of criticism all about that. And the reason that they didn't act is because the President Obama and his Secretary of State at the time tried to use the process, right? They actually right. tried to go to Congress to get authorization to act. They tried to, you know, kind of get a vote at the UN, and none of that was working. And so they kind of had their hands tied, right? But, you know, it was kind of a lesson, you know, if you're going to, you know, use the process and, you know, don't draw the law, you know, the red side, the right. line in the sand to begin with.
Right.
Years later, you know, Donald Trump is president. Syrians use chemical weapons, and he drops some cruise missiles on them, right, to kind of show, you know, kind of a penalty against, you know, what he saw as an unjust act. He was accused by the Russians as an illegal act of aggression, because technically, by the letter of the law, the United States should not have used, should not have taken upon itself in order to respond to an act, right?
Right.
So by the letter of law, you can sit there and say, well, yeah, it was illegal aggression. But, you know, the other end of the argument is, well, how do you respond to injustice of the world if the very agreement that you're using, you know, to build a better community is preventing you from acting? And right. and I think that's where presidents really have to make hard decisions. And some they'll right. decide that, okay, well, we're not going to kind of stretch it, and we're not going to, you know, we're going to kind of hold our breath and, you know, maybe sit on our hands a little bit. Others might say, hey, look, you know, this is, you know, this is serious enough that, okay, the rules say that I shouldn't do this, but you know what? We're going to do it anyway, because it's the right thing to do. And it's the right thing to do for our neighbors.
So it's ultimately, if you're looking at it in like neighborhood terms, each house is going to make their final decision on what goes on inside the house. The village will be ultimately secondary, right? That you're all, each country will do what is best for them in the end.
Yep.
Right. So national security, I think it's a topic that not enough people, like the average American, pays attention to. What do you think is the biggest reason why the average American should take some time just to learn about national security? What is the one thing you'd want just, you know, the average person to take away from?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is that, the American public is committing a lot to not only our national security, but the security of our neighbors, right? And you look in the news, you'll see it's an $800 billion defense budget, right? There's, in addition to that, you have a whole Department of Veterans Affairs. You know, there's a significant really commitment that the United States is making in order to ensure this rule-based order around the world is successful. You know, we started this in 1945 with the United Nations because we kind of realized that, you know, these big world wars just weren't worth fighting, right? If we can figure out some way to ensure that the community is working together in order to prevent conflict, and it's imperfect, we know that, but if we can figure that out, then we're much, you know, better position. And the United States has really taken the leadership in that from World War II. And so when we look at, you know, our military, you know, we're basically, it's not just about our own defense, right? We're defining our neighbors in the broadest possible terms. So we're looking at, you know, it's big in the news today, right, is Taiwan, right? And what is our responsibility to a free and independent Taiwan? But it's not just Taiwan. It's the, you know, the law of the sea, the free movement of goods around the world through the, you know, different, you know, straits and bodies of water, so that, you know, that other nations might want to influence in order to kind of use leverage, right, for their own right. good. And so it's a big job. I think it comes with a lot of responsibility and a lot of leadership, you know, from the United States part. And I think it's really important for just the average American, you know, to kind of understand what that role is. And I think when you do realize that and you can actually start to kind of see how, you know, with that role, that responsibility that we have, how defense budgets and how recruiting and how the importance of a strong military are to really kind of keeping this world order. And I think we're in a much better place.
Very good. I really, really like the way that you put that out for people to understand that just take a little bit of time to put some time into something as important as military, understanding recruiting and Department of Defense and what it means, and not just the traditional, you know, when there's a big conflict or war going on, what it means during times of peace and how we keep the peace. And
yeah, I mean, ultimately,
it's a very dynamic situation, obviously.
Yeah, ultimately, the whole idea of having a strong military is not to fight.
To secure, the saying? To prepare or secure peace, prepare for war? Or what's the saying?
Yeah, I don't know if I remember the saying.
It's the Metallica tune again. Don't tread on me, right?
Well, if I was to
secure peace is to prepare for war.
Yeah. If I was to take three elements, right? Yeah. If I was just to say, okay, if you were to look at, you know, kind of three things that really kind of drive us towards conflict, right? The first one is whether a nation is a dictatorship or right. a democracy. So, you know, democracies tend to be less, you know, kind of leaning towards conflict because, you know, we all get a vote in our elected leaders right. and we're not going to bail out our generals and our politicians that sent us to war, right? We want to ensure that if the military is going to be used, it's going to be some sort of like important and considerate kind of application of force. Dictatorships, on the other hand, you know, there's a much more of a willingness for a dictator because to defer cost onto their, you know, the cost of failure onto their people. So they're willing to take risks. They're willing to, you know, kind of create military action. They're willing to let the people suffer as long as it's the reward for them is there.
Ruled by the top, less checks and balances by far.
Yeah. The second part, I think, is that, you know, we want to make sure that kind of understand what's emotionally kind of these kind of dictators are connected to, right? If it's an event or a landmass or something like that, right?
Right.
And then what you want to do is just find out, are there ways that we can actually provide rational approaches to kind of maybe temper that emotion down, right? And those are that reciprocity, those international agreements that we into, right? Trade agreements and commerce and, you know, law enforcement agreements, whatever it is that they, you know, they kind of put into place. The third part about it for, you know, a dictator is where do they think they can win, right? So if you kind of look at the three elements, right, a dictator who has an emotional connection to, you know, a territory or some event, whatever, and they think they can win, you know, that's where you're really going to get into trouble, right? And you can see this kind of play out over and over again, right? It plays out in the Korean War. So it's, you know, North Korea invades South Korea when the UN decided that, hey, you know what, you know, we're going to recognize South Korea as a state, independent state. You know, North Korea is like, no, I don't, you know, we have our one, you know, peninsula policy. So what we're going to do is we're going to throw our tanks across the border and kind of invade, right? And it kind of leads to the Korean War. It's the same thing with Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait, right? So he wasn't happy where the border was drawn between, you know, Iraq and Kuwait and decides he's going to go through. And obviously we have examples here in Ukraine today. And we're going to see that the emotional kind of connection between China and Taiwan are evident. So we can't really we can export values, right? And we can actually, you know, kind of, you know, ensure that democracy is kind of supported around the world, but we can't turn dictators into, you know, democracies, right?
It's never worked in the past.
They were worked in the past, right?
Will never.
We can provide international agreements to provide a rational way to deter war, but we can't take the emotion out, right? But the one thing that we can do, and one thing that really the book, you know, advocates for a strong military is that we can show them that, you know, if they think they can win, then they're probably mistaken, right?
The show of strength, right?
So if the other two factors we have limited influence in, at least that military determinants provides that last gasp and ensuring that there's peace, right? So hopefully, again, we don't have to fight a war that, you know, you have all these planes and tanks and ships and all this kind of stuff that say, hey, we're willing to commit it if needed. Yeah, I mean, I think that's just what it comes down to.
Awesome. Very cool. Lastly, talking about national security and how do you feel it relates to what you're helping us with the American Warrior recruiting program?
Yeah.
And how that connects.
It's been great. I've actually really enjoyed working with you guys and really excited about the nonprofit side of the house. I think that's really going to drive this thing forward. And you're really a mission driven guy. And it was pretty evident that, you know, as a mission driven organization, that you got to have a nonprofit arm, right, to kind of demonstrate that.
Absolutely.
I think, though, what really kind of appeals to me and the relation, you know, about the book is really that same thing I can't start off with. Right. So I went to my wife. I said, hey, you know what? I'm going to write a book on national security. This is boring. Right. How do you, you know, reach out to people who aren't as interested in the military, who aren't naturally kind of because they have relatives or friends or family that are military that aren't naturally inclined to it. Right. And you see the stats that, you know, 6 or 7% are highly inclined. Another 6% are likely inclined to join the military. Right. So, you know, how do you really broaden that pool through engagement, right? So the book is, you know, how do I reach people who have no interest in national security to kind of tell a story that, you know, at least gets them to engage? The American Warrior Foundation and Strength Through Numbers is about, you know, how do I reach out to people who may not necessarily be as interested in military service, but they're interested enough to ask the question. And right. We've given them a platform to be able to answer those questions and then really kind of see the value of service, right? It worked out. It worked for me. The opportunity to join the Marines, I was really excited about that. I was a kid that just about failed out of high school, and I end up with a law degree from Georgetown. And, you know, it's, you know, part of that was the Marine Corps, you know, it's, you know, right. Going and, you know, kind of slugging through the, you know, the marshes of Camp Lejeune. And you know, there's countless stories of people who've kind of gone through that same journey, right? And I think there's plenty of opportunity for people who are interested in service to do the same thing.
And see, we just wanted to get people to explore the military service, just see what it looks like, just learn about it. You know, I think when people go into recruiting stations, they kind of feel that it's the final, they step inside, it's the final, like, oh man, they're going to throw me into boot camp. And right. I mean, it can be intimidating.
Yeah. It's a change.
And so we feel we are a bridge from the civilian community to the front step of the military, right? Where we are veterans who have been there, done that, who really just want to kind of come in and mentor people, make them feel more comfortable with learning about it. And if they're interested in making the jump, we want to help them get qualified and be there for them. Show them the good, the bad, and the ugly, right, Dave? I mean,
I think what we're going to do is that exactly right. And don't let the obstacle of being concerned about change, about boot camp, about, you know, whether I'm going to be successful, be, you know, too much of an obstacle for you to actually succeed, right? And for you to actually get the opportunity. And I'm probably running long here, but I just want to leave this one story. I have a friend of mine who his son was really didn't know what he wanted to do. He was in high school and, you know, kind of figured out college wasn't for him and kind of sat down and talked to me about the military and was interested in the Marine Corps. Yeah, you know, but we talked about with broader services. Really didn't know that it was for him. His parents really didn't think it was for him. But, you know, hopefully I had maybe just a little bit of a decision. He decided to join. He joined the Air Force. Today he's a crew chief on an F-35 in Japan. You know, he's just a few years into his military service, and the guy's going to be making more money than I am, you know, in like a couple of years. I mean, he's working with the most advanced technology you can think of. He's again, he's a kid that didn't know where he was going in high school, and now he's, you know, he's got his name on the side of the most advanced fighter aircraft in the world. And so it's the opportunities are great. And that's why I'm really kind of excited about, you know, the work that you're doing and hopefully that, you know, many more kids don't have that opportunity.
Absolutely. And Dave has been a phenomenal help to our organization. Really, he and I working together, I'm always a big vision guy, the big picture. And Dave is always challenging me in the best way to, okay, now look at this, this, and this. The details that are going to be all the difference between success and failure, right?
Yeah, sometimes I think I'm kind of a pain in the ass, but, you know, it's...
I love it. I love it because it's the details that we've been lacking in the past. I mean, just we didn't know that we didn't know yet, right? It's leadership with details, and I just can't use that word enough because that's where I struggle a little bit, just the first steps and tying in the little things that make all the difference.
It's a, you know, I did business development in a previous, or worked with business development guys in a previous job. And, you know, a lot of it is when you go in front of a company and you're saying, okay, this is, you know, this is my vision. You know, they buy into that right away. They can see that. The next step is, are they confident that you're going to handle their money right? Right. Are they confident that they're going to get the return on investment? And in the case of a nonprofit, are they going to see that their money is going into the benefit, the young men and women, you know, to improve their physical fitness, to improve their ASVAB scores, to get the mentorship that they need in order to, you know, to vision themselves as being successful in the military.
Right.
And, you know, that comes with hard work. You know that you got short sleeves on already because you're used to rolling up your sleeves.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have to really think through the business processes. Right. And you have to think through things that, you know, like compliance and, you know, kind of the legal things with the law firms and making sure all the X's and O's are where they need to be. And you can actually provide that sense of confidence to the people that you're going to, you know, kind of, you know, bring the message to.
The mission and the feel-good, heartfelt story has to match the tight execution of business and organizations being strong, right?
Exactly right.
That marriage, because you could have the best mission in the world if it doesn't function properly as an entity.
Yeah, I mean, you're asking companies to give money, right? And you know, that's not something that most of them take lightly. And so,
they're not successful because they aren't excellent with managing their own processes, right? Yep. I mean, they're a successful company that's in position to donate funds because they do things right way and execute on a high level.
Yep.
And they want to be, you know, aligned with other organizations that do the same.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think you're exactly on the nose here. And one of the things I really liked about your idea is, you know, you see, as a transitioning veteran, you know, I've kind of gone through a few transitions myself. And it's hard, right? And so you see a lot of organizations that have popped up on the back end of that life cycle, right? If you think about a life cycle, someone in the Marine Corps or someone in the military from, you know, the day that they sign their contract to the day that they finally exit into, you know, the back to the private world and where they make that exit is really up to them. There's a lot of that emphasis, you know, with nonprofits and other companies that support that back end. Right. That the transition back, that front end of the part is the part that's really underserved. And I think you're seeing
open season, right? It's really like a brand new road.
And I think you're seeing a lot of that realization. I just read some articles recently where, you know, the services are like, we need to be better at reaching out. We need to be better at screening who we put in recruiting duty. We need to be better at how we communicate the benefits of, you know, military service. And so in a lot of ways, they're a little behind you in terms of, you know, kind of recognizing the need.
Right.
They're a little ahead of you in terms of they got a big pocket, you know, that they can actually, you know, make these things happen. Right. And so there's kind of that. But you're definitely on the right track. And it's really good.
How do we marry it? Right.
Yeah, exactly.
How do we bring those two things together? Well, Dave, it's been a pleasure having you on. And thank you so much for everything you've done for us and all the time you've given us. Oh, yes. Yeah. Let's tell people while we wrap up here, Dave, how can people get a hold of your book? I know it's on Amazon and info.
Yeah, it's on just basically anywhere you buy books. You know, go to your favorite book retailer. You can get it. I'm certainly going to be working on a audio version. Hopefully it'll come out soon. I mean, if you're interested in today, and again, you know, I would say again, it's a great book for anyone who really wants to learn about national security. Really, it's a great book for somebody that you know in your life that has absolutely no connection to it. Right. So,
if somebody has questions for you, where would they work in the contact? You got email? Where would you want them to go?
Yeah, I think if you want to reach out to me, you know, I think probably the best thing would do is check out my LinkedIn account. You feel free to message me there, friend me, those kind of things. We're happy to answer any questions that you have.
And they can also reach out to us to get a hold of Dave too, if they want to just reach out to us directly, and we'll make sure they get connected. So I tell you what, it was a lot of fun getting back on the horse here. Episode 18. That's what we got here for you today. Stay tuned for the East Coast studio in the next episodes. We're going to kind of balance that out and keep you guys in the loop. But that's what we got for you today. And thank you for tuning in. And we'll be talking to you all soon. Take care.